It's very leisurely, so. All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13th, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
Give me a T!
T!
L!
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 T!
T!
S!
S!
What's that spell?
Let's
get it.
It's a little thing to make show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the gas, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny daddies that are licking bad. For the stroke, go direct to DLNGS.org. And I see challenges of Linux late down in Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the gas is just about to begin.
The Linux Late Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mind.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Yeah, another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 294. Today is Wednesday, April 15th, 2009. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
This is just a reminder that this weekend, Friday the 17th of April and Saturday the 18th, is Calgary Open Source Systems Festival at the Coast Plaza Hotel in Calgary, CosFest 2009. For more information, check out CosFest, the CosFest.ca. Check it out.
Cool. So we got a full house tonight. There's me, Pat. Dan is there, but he's not feeling too well, so he might jump off for a bit. Alan, you're here.
Hey, I'm here.
Dave Yates.
And I'll be quiet now.
off the painkillers.
Hello.
How you doing, Dave?
Good, good.
Painkillers, cool.
And our guest for tonight is Mental Guy, famed
Hello.
Inkscape developer. Welcome.
Yep. Have you been with Inkscape from the beginning?
Yeah, I'm one of the co-founders, actually.
Oh, sweet. That's a great, great and extremely important application. For people who are ignorant as to what Inkscape is, could you just explain it? Because you'll probably do it a lot better justice than I would.
Well, I can give it a try. Very briefly, Inkscape is a vector graphics application. In some respects, it occupies a similar niche to the GIMP in that it's application that is used fairly heavily for graphic design type work, among other things. But it is distinguished from the GIMP in that it's a vector graphics application rather than a bitmap graphics application. And one of the really important differences in that regard is with the GIMP, you have a bitmap, you have the surface that you draw on, and it all is mashed together into this array of pixels. With the vector graphics application, all of everything you're drawing is retained as an object in a structure. And so you can go back after you've drawn something and manipulate it individually. And you also get resolution independence, so you can render it at a high resolution for printing or low resolution for whatever, and it's, you're not tied to the resolution that you drew it at.
And that's what scalable vector graphics are, right? You're, no matter what resolution you have the graphic, it looks great.
Mm-hmm.
Either low, high, big, small, doesn't make a difference.
Yep. Well, in practice, if you're drawing fine details, they're not going to show up when it's small. And if you didn't draw fine details, then you'll notice when it's large. But even so, you won't get pixelization or anything like that. SVG, which is the file format that Inkscape uses, is a W3C standard for representing vector graphics. It's an XML-based format, and a number of web browsers actually have direct support for it now.
So you said it's when you're talking about graphics applications, I mean, Inkscape and GIMP come up quite frequently. So GIMP is always compared to Adobe's Photoshop. Would Inkscape be compared to Illustrator?
Very roughly, yes. Another project which compares to Photoshop, which I would also recommend that people check out, is Krita, which is KDE, a bitmap graphics editor, which is very nice in some respects.
So then what separates Krita from Inkscape, other than the fact that it's fairly well integrated with KDE?
Oh, well, it's a bitmap editor. It's more in more in GIMP space. I just mention it because it's a project that a lot of people don't seem to be aware of at all. When I think it actually, Krita is, I think, interface-wise, is a little bit more like Inkscape than the GIMP is, actually, despite being a KDE application. And the interface is actually one of the other things that distinguishes Inkscape from the GIMP. Way back when Inkscape was founded, we had to make some decisions about what the UI was going to look like, and early on, originally the project that Inkscape forked from, SotiPoti, basically was very GIMP-like. It had the floating toolbox and everything. But as time went on, it became really clear that we wanted to go a very different direction with the UI.
You know, that's interesting you brought it up, because that was one of the questions I wanted to ask you. What is the relationship of Inkscape to SotiPoti?
It's basically a straight fork. Back in, I think it was, before I was involved with Inkscape, I and most of the other, all of the other core Inkscape developers were, at the time of the fork, were SotiPoti developers. And basically we had set of different disagreements with the project maintainer, and we decided to go our separate ways. Some of those related to UI, some of those related to architecture, some of those just the way that the project was run. SotiPoti was very much a benevolent dictator project model, which is, you know, that works for some people. Inkscape tends to be more of, I almost want to call it a functioning anarchy, although the organization of the project is very informal. We have relatively open commit policy. You know, as long as someone demonstrates that they are capable of making useful contributions with a few good patches, then they get commit access. And we surprisingly have had few problems with that. And it's certainly enabled the project to go ahead leaps and bounds over past what would really even be possible if there was a single person doing accepting patches and doing integration work.
Yeah, I remember when I started using SotiPoti and then Inkscape came along, and I always wondered what they were very similar, but now it makes perfect sense. Is SotiPoti still in active development?
I always hate saying that it's dead at this point, but basically, yes, it's dead. It may be that there's someone who's, you know, still got the lights on over there, but as far as I know, there's not been any activity on the project for quite some time. I was originally kind of hoping that
the
study would continue. Yeah, it's definitely been inactive for a while. I was originally kind of hoping that Study Party really would keep going, just because competition keeps a project honest. Not that I think Inkscape has really had problems with that, but it always, you know, when you have another closely competing project, they tend to keep each other on their toes. And I think that's just generally competition is beneficial. But really, is the way it worked out, the for various reasons. Loris Kaplinski, the Study Party maintainer, part of the problem, too, is he just wasn't available very much because he had a number of personal issues or the things that he had to deal with. So that was, and given that Study Party very much was oriented around this, you know, very small set of people in terms of actually committing, if they're not available and actively doing stuff, then the project is basically dead in the water. With Inkscape, it's been very nice, even though I'm, I guess as close to a maintainer as Inkscape has, which, you know, between me and several other people who sort of split that role, I can be gone and have been gone for months at a time and then come back, and, you know, everything's still running smoothly because they're a lot of different people taking on different roles and taking on responsibilities that they need to keep the project moving and do a lot of things that I just physically couldn't do in terms of the time I have available.
So now Inkscape is a fairly large code base, and how large is the development team then?
I think we have something like 70 or 80 people with commit access right now. Most of them are not active at once. Some of them, we probably need to go back up a list and see if there are any people we can take off because they haven't been active in years or something. But I would say that at any given time we've maybe got 8 or so people really actively doing stuff with it. I don't actually view the... one of the downsides to this is that we have gathered a very large code base that I think is actually larger than it needs to be. We really do need to make more of a concerted effort to refactor and reduce the amount of duplication in the code base and just generally make it smaller, because every line of code in and of itself is, from a project management standpoint, from an economic standpoint, is really a liability rather than an asset. It's an asset in the sense that, well, if you have this code that does XYZ, then the fact that you can do XYZ, or you have a product that can do XYZ, that's an asset. But the fact that you have, 10,000 lines of code, that's a liability. It's a liability in the sense of you have to maintain the 10,000 lines of code. It's a liability in that, you have to do a build. You have to do... build 10,000 lines of code. It's a liability in the sense that to bring in someone new on the team, they have 10,000 lines of code to familiarize themselves with. I mean, hopefully it's designed relatively modular and they don't have to come up to speed on it all at once, but it's really unavoidable to be really productive on a code base. You need to have a fairly good understanding, at least at a high level, of pretty much the whole thing. So... yeah, Inkscape, it really is. I actually forget how big it is now. It's in the hundreds of thousands of lines of code range, somewhere in there, but it's been a long time since I've actually looked. But it would definitely be nice if it was a smaller project.
It's an impressive project, though, yeah. And aside from just being a vector graphics application, I mean, there's some other functionality inside of Inkscape that is quite interesting, like the collaborative whiteboard.
Yes, that's really generated a lot of interest. And that's a feature that the main thing that's hurt it is that it really hasn't had a single person who's been willing to actively take responsibility for it and keep it up to date and resolve some of the design issues that need to be resolved. it is usable now. The whiteboard actually uses Jabber as a protocol, as a transport. I would not necessarily recommend using it against just a random Jabber server because it generates a fairly high bandwidth of messages that some Jabber servers really don't like. But it's been very useful in the times I've used it, and a lot of people are really keen on the idea. I'm kind of hoping eventually, too, that we're really able to push the Ink Board thing in terms of getting funding for that or getting, you know, basically getting someone involved who can really direct resources at it. Because I think collaboration in the context of applications, you know, being able to do shared editing sessions and so forth, is going to increasingly become an important part of the desktop, really. I mean, you can see this stuff now, like, you know, a few years ago, SubEtha Edit, and a number of other collaborative text editors since. But really, the reason that 90% of people use computers is other people. And to the extent that applications don't support direct real-time collaboration, they're really not, you know, that there's always going to be that desire to be able to use the application as a way to directly collaborate with someone else. So I think generally that's an area where open source applications really need to be going at this point.
Well, are there a lot of, you know, not just open source, but any, you know, proprietary applications too that afford that kind of collaboration? Do you know, direct live collaboration? I'm not
sure. In the graphics area specifically?
In any area, but even in the graphics area?
Yeah, well, I mentioned the example of there are a number, especially in Mac OS X, a number of text and word processing type things out there. Of course, there's Google Docs, which has the collaborative spreadsheet and so forth. But as far as the desktop, it's really not something you see very often in the graphics area specifically. The only example I can think of offhand, I think Open Canvas at one point actually had support for some sort of collaborative thing, or I know it was either collaboration or recording editing sessions. But at least off the top of my head, I'm not really aware of any graphics applications, proprietary or open source, that really push the collaborative part of it. And even Inkscape doesn't push it as much as I think it should. But again, we're sort of resource constrained right now as far as being able to do that.
Is it hard to find people who want to work on that or who are qualified to work on that? What's more difficult?
The two kind of go together because the remaining things that need to be done are really things that require a certain level of, you know, it's basically anytime you're doing some sort of collaborative editing, it's basically the same set of problems you have with a revision control system like Subversion or Git or Bazaar or CBS or whatever. You have a bunch of people making changes locally, and then you ultimately need to reconcile those changes and be able to give everyone a new version with everyone's changes incorporated. It's really just an issue of it's a lot more real-time than a revision control system is doing, and you're not as interested in history necessarily. But actually doing a useful revision control system requires a certain amount of care and systematic approach and a certain amount of CS background that I don't really think is that common. And the same holds true if you're doing collaborative editing because it's all really the same set of problems. We have something that works at this point, but it's, again, it really needs someone to go through and rigorously look at it. You know, for example, how do we deal with editing conflicts where, you know, two people make changes that are directly in conflict? The existing code doesn't really handle that. That surprisingly doesn't make it that much less useful, but it does mean that in there are situations where it can get really whacked out.
What does it do at this point if there's a, you know, people make conflicting changes? Is it just chance it, whoever got there second?
Pretty much. Although, again, because the case of conflicts is not really explicitly handled right now, the two copies may end up diverging, or you may end up seeing other behaviors. It really kind of depends. The actual granularity of the changes are sent on is, you know, the basically the XML data model level. So it's, you know, whole attribute changes, or, you know, changes of node position in the document, add a node, delete a node kind of thing.
So are there any other features inside of Inkscape like the whiteboard that may not be the initial purview of vector graphics applications that you'd like to call out?
Well, I suppose there's always the ink bucket tool, which is not unprecedented in the vector graphics context, but there aren't really that many vector graphics applications that have anything like that. And that's basically just, you know, like the paint bucket tool in the GIMP doing an area fill visually. And in the case of Inkscape, actually creating a path based on the shape of that visible area that's all one color or whatever. That was actually a feature implemented by my roommate, who's also an Inkscape developer.
That's interesting. Why is that, though? Why don't a lot of other vector graphics applications implement, like, a bucket fill?
It's computationally hard. The way that John ultimately did it for Inkscape was to just render, render the visible area to a bitmap and then use a bitmap fill algorithm and convert that bitmap shape to a path. What most people think of in the context of a, I think actually Adobe Flash does have a bucket fill. And that is actually, it does it computation. It takes the shapes of all the relevant paths and cuts and takes pieces to make an outline of the filled shape. But that actually requires a lot of very specialized knowledge. Computational geometry is another one of those fields that it's a field that's very heavily involved in doing vector graphics. But in terms of overall knowledge of the art, it's very difficult to find programmers who really have much experience in it. One of the things that we've been trying to do, there's also a deficit of good libraries for computational geometry out there as well. The CGAL, or if ever pronounced it, CGAL, is the one of the few libraries out there that I'm aware of that's some sort of open source that actually has a lot of useful primitives, but it's still very limited. One of the things that sort of come out of Inkscape has been the lib2geom project, which is basically a project to create a general purpose two-dimensional computational geometry library to capture a lot of the knowledge, you know, algorithms and best practices and so forth for two-dimensional computational geometry so that in the future it's easier for people to write code that does things like, for example, actual geometric bucket fill. That is actually one of the features we have in mind for this eventually without needing quite so much specialized knowledge or, you know, having to learn a whole body of mathematics really from scratch. One of the people who's been very instrumental in that has been one of the other Inkscape co-founders, Nathan Hurst, who's currently working on a PhD in document layout. But he's got incredible mathematical background, and we've also been able to attract a number of other developers for lib2geom that also have that very focused mathematical and geometry background. to work on the library. And it's already made doing some things in Inkscape much easier, like, you know, 10 times less code to do the same operation as it did before, sometimes more efficiently. Kind of improvements.
Yeah, it sounds like the type of work that you guys are doing is very specialized, and that computational geometry and what is required to do a decent vector application like what you're doing, there's not a lot of people out there that could contribute adequately at first. It makes me wonder, how did you get such a large developer base? I mean, a lot of times we hear people are starving for developers, but you seem to have a pretty large group of active developers.
Well, there are several things. One is that despite what I've just said about a lot of things requiring very specialized knowledge, 90% of the things don't, especially not when all the important bits have already been built. A lot of features have to do with, for example, you know, basically taking objects at the SVG DOM level and, you know, moving them, you know, creating objects, moving them around, creating and changing attributes of them. Or they involve adding different things to the UI. And a lot of those things are not, since the core functionality has already been built, a lot of those things are not as big of a mountain to climb, so to speak, and you can draw on a lot of more typical experience to do them. Another thing is that Inkscape is, generally speaking, very open to contributions. We really try to foster a culture that's very very open to considering ideas and trying to build consensus around things and, you know, get things done that way. And it doesn't work perfectly, but it really, I think, it's been a pretty successful project from that point of view. Again, because we have been able to attract so many developers. Another thing that I think attracts developers is just that there are not really that many other applications in open source doing what Inkscape is doing in terms of being a vector graphics application that's really, extensively useful. One of the things that's really helped in that regard has actually been the fact that a number of our core people are actually using Inkscape for graphic design personally. For example, Buliet Biak, who is one of our core people going way back, he's probably had more influence than any other single person on the shape of the user interface. And he actually has a graphic design business that he runs, and he uses Inkscape for his day-to-day work in it. And that's one of the things I think is also helped. I think a really successful project in a particular field needs to have specialized knowledge as far, you know, whatever math or whatever is required to address that field, but also to have actual practitioners in the field among your core people. So they're actually using it, and they're dog-fooding it. And if something sucks for doing real production work, then it's usually going to be a point of pain for them, and it's more likely to get fixed. So although there's still a lot that gets needs to get fixed in Inkscape, but I think that's helped a lot compared to what it might have been otherwise. So I think that basically it's filling that niche, being open to contributions, and also having had most of the really hard infrastructure already built, so people don't have to start from. If someone wanted to write an application like Inkscape from scratch, at least until libraries like 2Geom become more mature, there's still an awful lot of really difficult work that would have to be done. So I think that's one thing that's actually kind of discouraged the development of other vector graphics applications, is just the initial work, unless someone wanted to fork Inkscape. But generally, so far we've managed to keep people happy enough that they haven't wanted to do that. So,
you know, when people talk about migration to Linux or some other FOSS choice in OS, And they always bring up, you know, GIMP as a replacement for Photoshop. People come in and say, well, GIMP doesn't have this feature or that feature. What would you say would be the equivalent in Inkscape? Like, what features might be holding Inkscape back from wider adoption from, like, Adobe's Illustrator or Macromedia's, what is it, Fireworks or something that might be equivalent?
Flash, maybe. I don't, Fireworks, maybe. In terms of features, one thing, people really want gradient meshes. And that's a tricky topic because Inkscape does use SVG as its base format. And generally speaking, we've tried not to make incompatible extensions to SVG. But SVG doesn't support gradient meshes either. So we've actually had a lot of discussion back and forth with the SVG working group about gradient meshes, how we might do those in SVG and then be able to do them in Inkscape. And so I've been involved in those discussions some. But some of it, too, is just kind of this thing where, the SVG working group, they might propose something, but then they want to see implementations of it before they actually finalize it. On the other hand, from our perspective as an implementer, we kind of want to have a final thing we can implement, so we don't end up implementing something, and then the final version of the spec changes it, and then we're kind of stuck, which actually happened to us with Float Text. So we're sort of trying to figure out how to proceed on that one between us and the working group, and also settle on a specific representation for gradient meshes and that kind of thing. Another thing that is a limitation is if you're using Inkscape for print, generally speaking, people are going to want CYMK for that, and be able to do spot colors and things. Spot colors is actually not that huge a problem. You can, I think we have enough in place now that you can create an ICC profile and do named colors. And very often when you're printing with spot colors, you just need to have the right color name in there, and the printer will worry about getting that set up. But in terms of actually being able to get a CYMK PDF out of Inkscape, there's not really a way to do that right now. And there's a lot of infrastructure that has to be built up. One of them is with Cairo. Cairo is very much an RGB imaging API right now, and we use Cairo for our PDF export, so we need to get that infrastructure built up. And we also need to figure out how to best represent this in SVG as well. SVG is also RGB-based, although there's a little more provision for dealing with other sorts of colors and things. But all told, there's a lot of infrastructure that still needs to go into that. I could go on. I think there's some other features I can probably think of, but is that basically what you were looking for?
No, that's good. So could you maybe elaborate a little bit on why is CMYK seem to be a stickler, or not just a stickler, but a bugger for, like, the GIMP and Inkscape? I mean, is it really that difficult to implement CMYK compatibility?
It depends on what you're doing and what you need from it. I don't think there are really any technical hurdles left for GIMP to do it at this point. In fact, the new version of the GIMP imaging library that they've been working on, I believe, does CYMK now. So there's not a huge set of problems there. There is, we also have the ICC color management stuff already implemented, and that's another thing. I guess the only place you care about CYMK is when you're actually doing work for print. And you don't always need it, but it's usually a good idea because if you just take an RGB image and you put that in a CYMK context, it's not necessarily going to be possible to get it to look nice because the two color spaces they don't overlap completely. And so you end up with a lot of colors in RGB that you just can't represent in CYMK. And a number of colors actually in CYMK that you don't really have a good way to express an RGB. This comes true especially in the case where you colors that differ, that are theoretically the same, but actually differ in terms of the proportion of black versus the CY, the cyan, yellow, and magenta inks together. You actually look different, even though they're theoretically the same, and that's something that graphic designers sometimes have to care about. So the obstacle for Inkscape is that first, we don't really have a good way to represent CYMK colors in Inkscape. We have a CYMK option in the color picker, but that translates back and forth to RGB, and it's actually the RGB that's stored in the document. And then the other half of the problem is that the output pipeline we have for CYMK that goes through Cairo right now, and Cairo doesn't yet really make provision for CYMK. So in Inkscape's case, it's basically an infrastructure problem. It used to be for GIMP, too. I think they've built most of that infrastructure now. It's just a matter of integrating it into the UI and doing whatever it is they need to do. But it matters a great deal for print work in graphic design, because otherwise basically print is not an RGB world at all, and it's very difficult to have a good handle on what your results are going to be like without actually being able to control things at the CYMK level. And the other thing about CYMK is that usually when people are using RGB, they're usually assuming it's a particular variant of RGB, sRGB or something like that. And so people just assume that, okay, well, I'll specify this color in RGB and everyone will know what I mean. That's really not the case in the CYMK world. In CYMK, there is no de facto CYMK color space. It all depends very heavily on the specific inks you're using, for example. And so there's just this whole other level of consciousness. You have to deal with the issue of the specific color space when you're working in CYMK, whereas with RGB you can kind of, for 90% of the things people want to do, not care. So that's kind of another complication.
Let me ask you a question about SVG, and maybe I'm off on this, but if I recall correctly, Steve Jobs had said he did not want support for Flash on the iPhone, that he was more interested in ramping up SVG to replace some of the functionality that Flash makes available through their products. What can SVG replace of Flash? What parts of Flash can be replaced by SVG?
Well, in theory, combining SVG with the other things like SMIL, there's probably enough there to replace all of Flash's functionality. Now, the bigger problem is that there's not really a standard profile of all that stuff together that any browser implements, and there's not really necessarily a standard profile that's actually implemented anywhere that even addresses, it's basically an issue of if you look at all the standards and you pick and choose pieces and put them together, you could build something that could replace Flash today, I think, at least in terms of functionality-wise, it goes. But the problem is that nobody implements all of those pieces in one place. In terms of what Flash actually could replace, or what SVG could replace Flash for today, certainly static images that are vector and scalable. In fact, it's probably better for that purpose than Flash. Particularly in terms of being able to just generate some XML, because there are lots of tools out there for doing that, and have it be displayable. Whereas with if you need to generate Flash from the server or something like that, then you need a library like libming, or Adobe's starting to release some open source tools to help with that. But it is really nice being able to just generate some XML and you can display it. That's also the Microsoft, what's it called? I can't think of the name now, but there's a Microsoft thing that's sort of in the same space, Flash and SVG.
Silverlight?
It also has a very nice... Yeah, well, Silverlight's based on it.
Or
the Silverlight display stuff is based on it, I should say. I can't think of it right now. But yeah, Silverlight is actually competing with Flash as far as an application platform goes. I'm really thinking more in terms of Flash as a, you know, for making still images and movies perspective. But yeah, you can, SVG is an application platform. Again, that's sort of a similar situation. I think you can make a useful application in SVG today, but it's kind of grunt work, and a lot of the pieces, you probably would want to use XForms for that, for example. So XForms plus SVG, I don't really know how many browsers implement that. And there's a lot of things that SVG doesn't really do. Form controls, that kind of thing, that would have to come from XForms, XHTML, or something like that. Yeah, I would have to say the main area where SVG would compete with Flash today is still graphics and limited animation. SVG does have provision in the SVG specification for animation. It's not that widely implemented. Inkscape doesn't do animation yet. There's certainly a lot of demand to do it, although one of the difficulties with doing animation in Inkscape is how do we make the user interface nice for animation while still having it be good for as good as it is now for static drawing, too. We don't really know what the answer to that is yet. But for other areas, like for web applications and that sort of thing, I really think JavaFX and Flex, and Flex is a Flash-based technology, and other things are really, and Silverlight, of course, are really... those are really what are the main factors in that space now. I think SVG is mainly going to be relevant as an actual group, just as a graphics format, because that's where what it's best at, and that's where it has done pretty nice properties that you don't necessarily see with some of the competing technologies like Flash. Flash is not really a good image format.
Flash is not good at a lot of things either, except crashing my browser all the time.
Yes. That's been a huge frustration of mine. I really wish there was a nice open source implementation of the Flash runtime, because Adobe can't seem to get it right. Plus, I prefer to see an open source version anyway, but it's even worse when the... I won't even go into that. I've been involved with the open source Flash efforts, both Gnash and what's the other one? SwiftDeck, a little bit. But they both do have quite a ways to go. I don't know. In some ways, in terms of what's actually available as a platform with an open source runtime, Adobe has been doing a lot of open source stuff with their content creation tools, but they still don't have an open source runtime. So out of Silverlight and, say, Silverlight, JavaFX, and Flex, really only JavaFX has the, I guess, a really good chance at an open source runtime, because you have OpenJDK now. The next best open, from an open source perspective, next best would probably be Moonlight, which is the mono implementation of Silverlight. But I still, one, that's, I don't know how complete that is, and two, I am still very leery of the whole patent situation with Silverlight, so it's not really a space I would want to spend a lot of time in terms of development, just because it's too many potential problems.
I think there's a lot of people that feel the same way, and there's an equal number that will contest you on that repeatedly, that there are no issues. Don't worry. These are not the patents you're worried about.
Yeah. Oh, and there's some truth to both sides. I've actually argued on both sides before, and my own position is somewhere in, probably in between where most people fall. But all the same, you know, if the position halfway between no doubt and total doubt is some doubt, then I have to say I'm somewhat doubtful.
And plus, there's a whole lot of other choices out there.
Yeah.
That you're not limited.
Yeah, it's not proved to be extremely pressing so far. To a lot of the replacements are good enough. It's kind of a shame in a way, because there's some things Silverlight and the .NET stack do that are really quite nice. But on the other hand, especially now that Java's been open sourced, the entire intellectual property situation around Java is a lot clearer than it is with .NET. I think, generally speaking, probably from an open source community perspective, our time is better spent on improving the Java infrastructure. That's actually one reason why I've been involved with JRuby. I'm a committer on that project.
Speaking of competition, and you had mentioned this before, that competition keeps you honest. What other FOSS vector applications, vector creating applications are out there? I know there was the Saudi Potty, which is not in development anymore, and Zara Extreme had a open port, but I don't think that's under development anymore. Is there anything else besides Inkscape?
Well, there's obviously things like Daya. People still use Xfig, which is fine for a lot of purposes. The Bill Zara thing was, I think what kind of what killed Zara is that they decided to do the open source thing, except not quite. The Zara renderer was always closed source. They basically gave you a binary blob along with the source tree. And that really discouraged a lot of people. There was an effort to replace that binary blob with Cairo so that the whole Zara code base would be open source. But they, you know, basically because they were really kind of aggressively hostile in that sense to the whole, you know, actually doing things the open source way, they never really got the uptake that was required to for people to spend enough time and effort to replace that component, and it sort of was still born as an open source project, which is a shame. We had a lot of interesting conversations with the Zara guys, between us, them, and us and Inkscape, but they were never quite willing to you know, go all the way, and so as far as open source went, and so they ended up kind of neither being quite a closed source application, neither quite an open source application, so they sort of exist in this limbo of neither fish nor fowl, and they had a lot of difficulty attracting interest as a result. I'm trying to think what other applications there are. There is a KDE application. I mean, there's actually a couple. I can't remember if it's a Qt application or a TK application. There's Sketch. I think that's a TK application. I can't remember the name of the KDE application I was thinking of, but there is one. I don't know how actively it's maintained. It basically would be the counterpart to Krita. But coming right now. There's OpenOffice Draw, of course, which some people do use for things. But, yeah, I can't really think of any others, and I'm hoping that someone listening to this interview will, you know, notice when I've forgotten and email me and say, hey, you forgot to mention blah, blah, blah. And oh, yes. And then, but right now, I don't really feel like the vector graphics application ecosystem in open source is really very healthy right now. There seems to be a point where that most vector applications get to. I mean, they get to the point where you can draw shapes and move the control nodes around and design colors to them and hopefully print and basically maybe have some text functionality in there. And then a lot of them seem to stop. And the reason is a lot of them start to hit the area. For example, if you want to take two shapes, this is a functionality that's in Adobe Illustrator, it's in Inkscape, it's in Adobe Flash. You want to take two shapes and use one to basically cut a piece out of the other, or basically combine them into a single shape without any extra lines where they're touching or overlapping. That starts to get into some really heavy-duty math. And that's basically the wall that a lot of projects tend to hit with vector graphics. Another one tends to be stuff like outputting print-ready PDFs, which is the problem even Inkscape has. So I think there's kind of a really sort of a technological hurdle there. That is one of the reasons why the vector graphics ecosystem is not as rich as it should be. Again, that's something we're trying to address with Live2Geom, basically reduce the barrier to entry into the whole vector graphics thing by making computational geometry much easier, making writing good computational geometry code much easier, and be able to do more interesting things with shapes in code. With a lot less effort up front.
It's kind of interesting. I've heard you bring that up repeatedly, is the desire for competition and with the libraries that you're working on, because you don't really hear too many proprietary applications saying, we want to bring more competition to the table by writing a library that will benefit, people writing our similar applications and give us more competition and sort of, rising tide lifts all boats kind of attitude.
Mm.
It's nice.
Well, to be fair, in a proprietary setting, that they really, it's harder to take a, when the whole, basically, the thing with proprietary software is, the understanding there is that the owner of the proprietary software has, a certain level of control over what can be done with the code. And they basically use that control. That control is basically what they sell to you. So you want to be able to use this program to, do X, Y, Z. And if you also want to do A with it, then, pay us some extra money and we'll let you do that until your subscription runs out and then you'll have to pay us again. And so the whole proprietary software thing, it's basically you get to use this, you basically say, well, okay, I agree not to use the software to do certain things on my computer, and there may be technological measures to enforce that. There usually are. And so I'm ceding this amount of control over my computer by running this software, and if I want more control again, I pay you, the proprietary software maker, to basically resell me some more ability to use this in certain ways. That becomes really blatant when we get into situations like DRM. Situations where there's, like an agent running on the machine that monitors things, and the whole copy protection thing with video games that makes everyone's lives really miserable, unless, of course, you're pirating the game, and then you don't have to worry about it because it's all been removed. I think I lost my train of thought there, but Yeah, basically the whole point of proprietary software is that you're basically, the user is willing to sacrifice some measure of control over the software on their computer. And then the proprietary software maker exploits this to, in order to be able to basically resell someone the ability to use their own computer. And, of course, putting it like that is a little bit unfair, because for shrink wrap software, that's normally the only way that proprietary, from a business perspective, that most shrink wrap software makers are set up to be able to fund development. I mean, they do need to be able to pay the programmers for their labor, and for whatever support and other services they offer. But the big question is, are there other ways to subsidize that? If it really is impossible to actually pay the programmers for their labor rather than having them essentially work for free and then subsidizing it through other means, like collecting licensing fees and so forth. That's not something I really have a great answer for. It's actually an issue that comes up in open source as well. Because in open source, I mean, you have a lot of people that are working, at least in theory, for free. In practice today, in open source, a lot of the programmers who work on open source are actually doing it as part of their job. So they are actually being paid to do that work. But on the other hand, we do still have a problem that there are a lot of things. I mentioned earlier with Inkport that we're having a problem, essentially, that it's something people are really interested in, but we don't have a really good way for people who have capital and are interested in and aren't coders themselves to be able to invest that capital in that feature specifically. Because capital isn't just money. It can also be resources or whatever. But, certainly when you have someone who has programming skills and they spend time on a feature, that's a specific sort of capital. But that's really the only, right now, that's the only sort of form of capital that most open source projects are really set up to accept, at least go towards the development of a particular feature. It is true that in Inkscape, at least, we've been trying to find ways to solicit other forms of contribution. For example, people writing documentation and tutorials and other non-technical things like that. But there's still a problem of, for example, the Paint Bucket tool. My friend John actually wanted that for his comic. He does a comic which he draws in Inkscape called A Moon of Clarity. It's very good. It's an all-ages comic about a boy named Johnny and his life experiences and stuff. But he really wanted a tool to automate the task of filling in shapes. Which is actually really tedious if you don't have something like a paint bucket to do it with. Now, if, say, the Adobe Illustrator didn't have something like that, and Adobe personally didn't have a particular interest in that feature, there really isn't any amount of money short of buying the company that you could pay them to implement that feature for you, which is one of the nice things about open source. John happens to have a programming background, had enough knowledge that he was able to go in and spend about 2 weeks to implement that feature. But there are a lot of situations like Inkboard where we have an awful lot of people who are interested in it, but most of them are not programmers, or if they are programmers, they're not programmers who necessarily have a good handle on how to solve the remaining technical problems it has. So the question comes, are there other sorts of, is there a way to get other sorts of capital that we could invest into that somehow in order to be able to get someone to work on that feature for us? And we don't really have any good infrastructure in open source for that right now.
Matt, though, we got a question from the IRC about Inkscape's auto-tracing features.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is this totally done by a third-party library or application?
Yeah, Potrace. It is a library. I've got to unlock my laptop to read IRC here. I just realized I probably should have been following along on IRC, shouldn't I? But yeah, it's implemented by Potrace. Before Potrace, we used Autotrace. Autotrace is actually an application that I worked on for a while, or a library that I contributed a little bit to. I contributed the PNG support to Autotrace. I haven't really been involved with Potrace. But Potrace is really a pretty cool library. I mean, you basically give it a bitmap. It thinks and it gives you back a a vector style description of a path that that describes the shapes in the image, and that's basically what we hook into for that.
I have a question for you regarding your collaboration with GIMP and other projects. I noticed that you can import Inkscape SVG files into GIMP fairly easily. Do you guys actively work with the GIMP project to make that possible?
We do collaborate a little bit. Inkscape supports the GIMP palette format for palettes, the exchange in the other direction. I don't actually know offhand if we really had that much involvement with the SVG support in GIMP, which I think is all done via librsvg, which is an SVG rendering library that doesn't really share any code in particular with Inkscape. We certainly had some conversations with the GIMP folks, and we've collaborated on a few things. There's some work that was done on a richer palette file format as part of the Create project, which is sort of a consortium of people from different open source graphics projects. And there's also events like LGM, the Libre Graphics Meeting. The next one is going to be the beginning, like the first week of May, I think, which is basically a conference to bring together all of the open source graphics application people and people, the developers and to some extent users, all in one place. And it's been a very nice conference. I've been to it before. I gave a presentation at it, I guess, a couple of years ago about making comics in Inkscape. In terms of specific collaboration, I don't know there's really been all that much. A project that Inkscape has probably collaborated directly a little more with Scribus, which is basically it's a Qt application. It's basically comparable to Adobe InDesign. It's used for page layout and making printed publications type stuff. We've worked directly with them in the past on various things, including improving, to some extent, SVG import and producing SVG in a way that they can use usefully in some respects, I think. That's all I can think of right now. I've sort of actually been out of that loop a little bit. I didn't go to the last LGM, and I probably won't be at this one. Well, I know I won't be at this one, because just the way my schedule is working out, I'm going to have to be in Spain not long after that, so it's a little too much travel right then. I don't know. I'm sort of rambling here, so rescue me by asking another question.
How did you get involved with Scribus to begin with? I mean, what drew you to collaborating and working on that, on the application? And then, I mean, what is your background, and how does that all come together?
My background personally?
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't personally done that much with Scribus, first of all.
Not Scribus, I'm sorry, Soddy Potty. I apologize.
Soddy Potty, okay. Okay, Comics, actually. I do a lot of things, but one of them is I'm really kind of involved in the whole indie comics world, and I really wanted to have a digital workflow for making comics. And, you know, being a more or less exclusive Linux user, that didn't leave me with too many options. You know, short of using, say, Illustrator or the GIMP, Illustrator or Photoshop in Wine, the GIMP improved over the years. So did Cody finally appeared. For the comics, one of the reasons why I really prefer vector over bitmap is that to get nice results, what I consider nice results for print, I need to work at a fairly high resolution. And having older computers, that's often a lot more memory than they actually have, so you end up swapping practically to death as the machine's totally out of memory and you're sort of trying to grind through this picture. Whereas in the vector context, at least until the image gets really, really complex, it's generally speaking at a lot less memory for the same image that you can print in pretty much any resolution you want. I mean, if you want to put it up on a billboard, you can, although as I said earlier, that if you actually take a picture you drew and blow it up that large, you're probably going to see things that you're going to want to fix for printing it at that size. But the thing is, you can, and without totally, in a single document, without blowing all the memory in your computer. That was the big thing for me. I really wanted to do vector graphics, you know, comics in vector graphics. My degree is actually in graphic design as well, so I'm sort of coming from that background too. That really motivated me to get involved with SodiPoti. SodiPoti never really got to the point that it was completely useful to me. It's kind of weird, but what I was saying earlier about there being a certain technical hurdle, there's, in terms of being really useful for an artist, there's also a certain amount of user interface polish and niceties that you really need to have before it gets usable on that front. And that's sort of a whole other set of expertise in terms of, to some extent, human factors and usability experience. But absent that, or even with that, you also need to have people who have really who have the domain knowledge of, you know, graphic design and are actually the sort of users you want to track, because that's the only way you're going to know about the user interface issues that you really need to solve and work out. I think that's the other thing that tends to limit the growth of the vector graphics application is, well, any graphics application, is unless you have among the core developers, you're able to get some people that really have that background, because otherwise you're really just not going to have a clue how to make it useful if people are going to, from an artist's point of view, people are really going to want to be drawn to it and want to use it. At least over time, the biggest advertisement for an open source program is word of mouth, because it's useful for people and they tell their friends. But if, you know, if it's a pain to use, you hit a wall eventually. I mean, to be honest, that tends to be a problem for the GIMP, I think, because pretty much everyone I've talked to has been very uncomfortable with this interface, at least if they were coming from an artistic background. And that's not just because it's different from Photoshop. I mean, because obviously there's going to be some, you know, it's okay if it's different from stuff to some extent. Although if there's certain conventions that are universal, it's sometimes a good idea to follow those. But the big experience with, you know, a lot of open source graphics applications is they're physically cumbersome to use. You know, some common tasks require way too much mousing around and other stuff like that. And again, Inkscape's not perfect, but the fact that we've had a lot of artists involved directly in development has helped us streamline a lot of artistic tasks to the point where there's enough people who are happy with Inkscape's interface as artists and use it that we have kind of been able to build up that user base and, to some extent, developer base. I'm sorry, I've completely lost track of your original question now.
Oh, no, that's okay, because it brought up some more questions that we have regarding your interests. You work on indie comics. Now, do you do print or web-based comics or both?
Both. There's not really that much of my stuff on the web right now. I do have one comic that I really had to abandon almost a couple years ago now, and I'm trying to get back to, but I've got a lot of other responsibilities to dispatch first. And, of course, as far as print stuff goes, I mean, you know, we're talking indie here, so, you know, photocopied comics stapled together, that kind of thing. Nothing you'll find on Amazon.
So you mostly distribute through local comic shops?
Yeah. Oh, not even. You know, I just go to shows, give them to friends, that kind of stuff.
Do you have a website or anything that mm-hmm. you would want to throw out there?
Well, I haven't updated it in a while. The actual website for my comic, that the one I've been working on most recently, I'm sort of reluctant to plug it because the last few pages of it, I really want to go back and redo. But having said that, the site is lastbus.ridia.net. And that's basically kind of...
Lastbus.what?
.ridia.net, R-Y-D-I-A. It's like the sorceress from Final Fantasy V.
Oh, okay.
Ridia. Actually, URLs are one of the things that are often... Let me go ahead and type that in the chat. So anyone following along there. Let's see.
Yeah, if you were following along in the chat, another question that was asked in there was what comics or any comics at all do you like to read right now?
Well, let's see. Comics. I don't have any... In terms of print comics, there are probably not that many that I actively follow right now. There are a lot of web comics I read. Gunner Creek Court, Sluggy Freelance to some extent, Scary Go Round. Let's see. There's actually Digger is a good one. Trying to think who else. There's a whole list that I can't think of right now. Lackadaisy Cats. There's the Dada Detective, although unfortunately they're also print. They also do print. I followed them for quite a while. They're sort of in a hiatus now, though. But it's a great comic. And the artists and writers are great people. Just trying to think. In terms of print stuff, I tend to pick up a lot of anthologies. The Flight Anthology is every... edition of that, every volume of that is just brilliant stuff, cover to cover, pretty much. In terms of individual artists, I don't know, again, I there's actually quite a few people. That I haven't already mentioned in among the webcomics. Of course, there's Carla Speed McNeil's Finder, which brilliant stuff. Not for everyone, but it's brilliant. Let's see, what else? So this, I started this interview in total programmer Inkscape mode, and now I'm trying to shift mental gears to comics, and it's like, wow, this whole other world here. I really haven't been following print comics that much. I've never been into superhero comics, so I can't really If I had to pick a favorite superhero, it probably would be Spider-Man. Batman's also quite cool.
Batman's dead.
Again?
Yeah, no, he's dead. They killed off Bruce Wayne and burned him up.
Well, but, you know, that doesn't really stop them.
Until they need more money.
Yeah.
Captain America and Bruce Wayne are dead, so...
No one's ever dead, Dan. Don't you know that about comic books?
I don't think Captain America's coming back. I think they'll stick with that one. Maybe Bruce Wayne, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's just... I don't know. At least... I have some interest now in the gold and silver age comics. Just, they were fun and pretty cool and stuff, but the... Particularly in terms of superhero comics these days, it's like, you know, I think it's like, I read an interview with Alan Moore a while back, and he was talking about how one of the things that sort of bothered him was that it was like all of the comic writers had read Watchmen and then decided that rather than... What he was saying in the interview correctly, he was trying to make a criticism, and they all were sort of like, you know, yeah, let's do this, rather than, you know, oh, hey, this is kind of, yeah, they said this kind of took it as a suggestion rather than a criticism. Really not a, there's some really good work that I've read out there. But for the most part, every time I've picked up a modern superhero comic, it's been sort of just way too cynical for me, usually. Either cynical or just badly written, or which is a shame, because it can be done well. I've seen some that are. There's nothing inherently wrong with the genre, but although I would kind of like to see in the U.S., other types of comics being done too. It has sort of completely over in the U.S. completely destroyed all the other comic genres, which I'm not too happy about. But yeah. So that's sort of me trying not to go off on a long rant about that, I suppose. So.
We had another question. Well, actually, I'll probably switch gears, but before I do, back to Inkscape a second, a question came in about, did you see the Watchmen movie, and what did you think of that?
Oh, sure. I did see it. I kind of regret having seen it now. I've seen the comic as well, and... I should probably not spoil it for anyone who is still planning on seeing it, but I think they handled the disaster at the end a lot better in the movie, rather than bringing in the squid, which was just totally random in the comic and wasn't very economical from a writing standpoint. But as far as the movie goes, they needed... At very least, they needed to have a different director for it, because the gore was just completely over the top. And one of the things that really hurt the movie was, you know, aside from any problems inherent to the source material, one of the things that really hurt the movie specifically was that they really didn't have enough time to actually do the characterization and tell the story. And unfortunately, they spent not most of the time in the movie, but they spent an awful lot of time in the movie with these lingering cuts. And just, you know, the gore hanging from the ceiling or whatever, or, you know, awkwardly long sex scene in the middle of the movie, and it's like, and they didn't, and of course the slow motion battles, again, basically they had this systematic pacing issues throughout the entire movie, where they were, you know, doing all these visually dramatic things, I suppose, but that really didn't advance the movie from a writing or pacing point of view, and really didn't give enough space that you that really build up the characters. And then the other thing is, there's something I think I mentioned, that the way that they tied up the movie was quite good, versus the way that they did it in the comic with the squid. But yeah, they needed to have a different director for it, for one thing. The other thing is, it kind of, after having, I don't know, there are a lot of really interesting and clever things that were done in the comic that just didn't make it into the movie. And it's kind of hard for me now to look at the comic and not, I just complained earlier that way too many superhero comics are way too bleak and cynical and so forth, like they take an Alan Moore a little bit too seriously. And unfortunately, a lot of the same stuff is there. I mean, it was deliberate on Alan Moore's part. He was trying to do this sort of very subversive, cynical thing. But it's hard for me to enjoy that. I mean, that's just not the sort of thing that really appeals to me at this point. So that hurt the movie. It's kind of weird, because I actually liked the comic a lot more before I saw the movie, because the movie sort of took the same thing, but without all the interesting things. There's some choices in the movie that were still really artistically good. I don't want this to sound like the movie was the worst movie ever. It was technically, there are a lot of really good technical decisions that were made. Some really good screenwriting decisions as well. Versus the comic, but yeah, so I know
you
people
have
who,
to wait for the 5-hour director's cut.
Yeah, I have to wonder about that, because I really don't trust Zack Snyder's judgment as a director. There are
Mental,
the case,
have you seen the motion comic?
Motion comic?
Yeah, there's a motion comic version of Watchmen on DVD.
Hmm. No, I haven't seen that. Is that literally?
I was curious if you knew.
No, I.
The original art.
Okay, so it's actually taken directly from that.
It's everything but the under the hood segments. I mean, it's frame by frame, but they've added limited motion and narration and music. Now, I don't know how they did it. It was really pretty amazing. 5.5 hours long.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of hard for me to watch motion animations that are done like that, because at least if they're taking from a material that was really done as a comic. One of the things about doing that is you actually end up sacrificing a lot of the, especially as in the case with Watchmen, where they did a lot of visually clever things. Like there's one of the Watchmen issues, for example, all the page layouts, if you split it down the middle and look at the pages in the opposing pages in the signature, the page layouts in terms of the panels and everything, and even some of the elements within them, are actually, it's a mirror image throughout the whole thing. It did a lot of really clever things along those lines in the print comic. And as soon as you take something like cut it up and turn it into motion graphics, then you at least lose those sorts of things. And if it's, you're actually taking the comics, basically taking pacing and plotting and so forth directly from the comic. I don't want to say it would suck without seeing it, but it's very hard to do and have the same pacing that worked for comic work in film. And it may be that it may be the way to watch it is not to watch it as a film. It may be that, it's to watch it like the, basically watch it like a comic, if that makes sense. But then on the other hand, it's already sacrificed a lot of the really interesting things they did. just by pulling it out of the visual layout and the relationship between the panels, the pages, and so forth. And some of the little clues that they drop in, the various things which are related to that. So I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I'm not going to say it's good or bad. I'm just kind of surprised that they did that, and I'm also kind of wondering if I were making something like that. I'm not sure how I would actually make it work as film.
Dave Yates, question for you, because I haven't seen the motion comic. Was it? Do you remember the old Thor cartoon back in the, I think it was late 60s into the 70s, and they replayed it a few times, but it was like essentially comic book panels. There was almost no character animation other than just a drawing that they moved around.
I don't remember that.
No?
No. I agree with everything Mental said about it. I mean, I've watched the motion comic, and I've read the book four times. You do lose some of the things that are there, you know, as far as page layout and, you know, some of the questions that's done in the book. But having read the book, like I said, probably four times, I noticed stuff I hadn't noticed before watching the motion comic. It was pretty cool. I mean, it was a different way to watch the book, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Mm. Yeah,
with
I guess that was actually kind of
stuff, and it was.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are things that you can do in the film motion, like for example, a zoom in to direct the viewer attention that there are equivalents for in comics, but they work differently. So
yeah,
but does sound like they didn't just translate the comic, they actually tried to do some film things with it too, with the material as well. So that I'm a little less skeptical now, I guess, good to hear you say that. But
it's definitely worth $13.
All right. One quick question. Back on Inkscape, let me roll back here, because it was from R.F. Quirin, and he had asked whether or not. Oh, crud! Now I lost it. It was before we started talking about all this comic book stuff. Oh, here we go. He wanted to know if there are any plans for proxy objects, like what is used in Blender.
Let's see. Proxy objects. You mean the Blender sequence editor? I guess that would be.
I believe so.
Yeah. It's been talked about. I don't think there are any active plans for doing it, but it is something that's useful. For the listeners who are not familiar with proxy objects in Blender, that's basically, well, for example, in the context of the sequencer, you may have a video or just an animated scene that takes a lot longer to render to display than you could do in real time. So you basically pre-render it to a proxy object, which is basically a bitmap-based cache of the whole thing in a lower resolution. So you can keep working with this document in real time. It's obviously not editing the proxy element, or that would need to be regenerated, but you can otherwise keep working with the document in real time, have an idea of what it's going to look like, rather than having the thing just get slower and slower and slower as you have this really complex element in the document you're working on. So in the context of Inkscape, what that would look like, we do already have a feature called Make a Bitmap Copy, which basically you select an object, make a bitmap copy, and that puts a bitmap in the document, which is a rendered copy of the object you had selected. But the object is still there, and there's not a really convenient way in Inkscape right now to basically treat those like a single object that you can sort of flip back and forth between the pre-rendered proxy version and the actual complicated object. when you need to edit it or something. So that's the part we still need to do, is to figure out how exactly that would work. I don't know if that it would make sense to do that in terms of like an SVG switch statement or to implement that some other way. It's not something I've personally thought about a lot, but it has been discussed. It's something that there's interest in doing, but there's sort of need to make some technical decisions about how to do it, and also how to basically find someone to actually do it, something like that.
I guess so, the last question that we had from the IRC so far was, is there any plans for an eventual 1.0 release of Inkscape?
Maybe. In theory, we sort of have criteria right now. When we implement all of the SVG features from, I think it's SVG 1.1, then we'll call it 1.0. In practice, I don't know if that'll ever happen, because there's a lot, and there's some features that I'm not sure anyone necessarily wants, except for the sake of completeness. Honestly, one of the reasons that we didn't go to a 1.0 version, even though people keep suggesting it to us, is because it sort of sets expectations. Inkscape is still very much a work in progress. If we called it Inkscape 1, then I think people would have much harsher expectations for it. And that doesn't necessarily really help anyone. I mean, we don't want to oversell the product. It is what it is. If people find it useful, that's great. If not, if it just needs a little bit of work, they're welcome to help out. And if it doesn't do what they need, then we understand that too. And we're trying to make it better. But it's almost like a 1.0 version has this sort of a certain amount of pressure associated with that in terms of expectations, and not giving a misleading impression, I think, to the users either. So that's kind of my own feeling about it anyway. A lot of the developers feel similarly. Not everyone agrees. But on balance, I think Inkscape is not going to have a 1.0 version for the foreseeable future. It's not like having a version number that starts with 1 is actually a feature that anyone needs. Even if a lot of people ask for it, which I don't completely understand why people are so keen on it, because it's just a number. But
well, here's a question here that's not worried about numbers, because we don't care about numbers either. But what about keeping parity of features between Windows and Linux versions of Inkscape? For instance, the OpenClipArt.org integration is Linux only. What are the thoughts behind keeping a parity of features between the Windows and Linux versions?
We try to do it as much as possible to the extent that it's technically possible. That's not to say that doing the OCaL integration is impossible in Windows, but there's a lot more. One of the things on Linux is that, at least for some things, like, for example, interacting with web application, it's a lot easier to get infrastructure to set up to write a program to do something like that. And so with that particular feature, we had a situation where one of the libraries that uses doesn't really build on Windows, and there's something like that. It's not a feature I've been personally involved with at all. Some kind of going off of vague recollections and mailing list discussions here. It's something I think if there's interest in it and someone comes forward to actually do whatever work's required to make that build on Windows, then that's great. But in that particular case, it was normally we try to have whatever we do work on all of the platforms we support. But that was a situation where it was a really, really interesting feature that the people wanted to do. And at least in the really short term, it wasn't practical to do that on Windows. So, and I hope that that gets addressed, because I don't really like to see any of the platforms being second class in any sense. The other thing with having a feature that applies only to a specific platform is that it gets harder to, particularly if it's not the primary platform, gets harder to maintain it unless people are using it constantly. I would love to say that we have a great regression test suite and so forth with Inkscape, but to be honest, we don't have as good a testing setup as I'd like, and in practice, the only way that the code gets tested is people actually using it. So that's another reason why having something on only a single platform is not good, because that limits the amount of testing it gets.
So what can we look for in Inkscape 0.47? Any big features coming up, or additions or changes?
Oh, that's a hard question. The short answer is yes. The long answer is that, unfortunately, it's been long enough since our last release that I've actually lost track of what's new. I usually use the versions from Subversion. We do actually have, however, a wiki page where we track the release notes. Let me pull that up. I'll drop a link on IRC. I can summarize some of that. So, okay, let's see here. Geekscape.org. Release notes for 047. Okay, let me drop a link in the channel here. Okay. So, and that basically summarizes all of the features. We have much better support for importing PostScript and PDF. We have PDF, PostScript, and EPS import export improvements. We have HPGL export, JavaFX export. Are both new, I think. I think there have been some improvements to PNG export. Bug fixes, actually, looks like. We have added autosave, which I think a lot of people are going to want. It's not on by default, because there's trade-offs with having that. We have a lot of new effects that you can apply to, path effects that you can apply to, things, most of which have a lot of interesting artistic uses. Let's see. You can assign live effects to groups now, rather than just paths directly. You can also apply more than one live path effect at a time to an object. Let's see. I think I mentioned earlier, too, that we generally try to avoid doing anything incompatible with SVG. The way we had to do live effects was that we basically take the output of the effect and stick that in the SVG as a regular path or a regular object. So if you open it up in a regular SVG viewer, you still see the same result. Let's see, what else? I think I was the one who implemented this. One thing people asked for was a way to temporarily turn off filter rendering, because filters take a lot of CPU, and if you're working on a complex drawing, that can kind of suck. So there's a no filters was added as a play mode, but besides just regular and wireframe. So people should want that. There's also a tunable filter quality for all the filters, not just blur now. Let's see, what else? We allow rotating guides with the mouse. Um, which as I think some people will find very useful. I've done a lot of cleanup of the snapping code. Has some support for built-in spell check. Let's see, what else? It does have it's kind of an obscure feature, but it has an interactive shell that you can use to do various things. It's basically based on the command line, existing command line functionality. And regarding what Dowdle just said, regarding 1.0, Inkscape is good enough to call 3.0. I appreciate your confidence, Dowdle, and it is pretty cool, but I still have reservations about calling it 1.0 personally. I guess it helps that I know how the sausage is made, and I know there's a lot of technical polish that's required. Even if the features look pretty cool, we still need to do a lot of work in terms of improving the code and making things stable and that kind of thing.
Well, it's always worked wonderfully for me.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, I guess it does tend to affect you after a while, after you see... Most of the stuff I hear about Inkscape is bug reports. So that sort of affects my point of view a little bit, maybe.
I mean, I've been using it for like about 5 years now. And I've never had a problem with it that I can recall, stability-wise. And it's always, it's always worked great for me. I've loved it.
Cool. Well, that's good to hear. And it's just unfortunate that, people don't file bugs saying, hey, this works for me. I've never had a problem. Please, can you break something now?
I even tried out the whiteboard when that came out. Set up my own Jabber server to do it, too.
So you've been using the whiteboard actively and having luck with that?
I did use it. I set it up and I had it working, but I didn't have anybody to work with it.
Ah.
So, and then I stopped using my Jabber server, and that was a couple of, God, that was about 2 or 3 years ago, I think I did that.
Hmm. Yeah. Definitely, as I said, the whiteboard stuff is definitely something I want to revisit. It would be nice, too, if there is a way to set that up without requiring a Jabber server to host. It may be that we finally... I haven't been following carefully lately, but it may be that if we add some sort of throttling or something, it won't crash Jabber servers quite so much. I just remember when we were originally testing the feature, we managed to crash several of the Jabber servers that we were using it on, so that was kind of a little bit scary.
When are we going to see meshes?
It may actually be resolved. Gradient meshes?
Sure. It was a question in the IRC. Any plans for meshes in Inkscape?
Yeah, that was actually when I was talking about gradient meshes. I assume that's what they're referring to, that that's something we'd like to do, and we basically need to nail down something with the SVG working group as far as how to express gradient meshes in SVG and then have an actual standard way to do that, because we don't have that right now. And we're, to some extent, actually limited by the what you can express in SVG in terms of what features we can do. So yes, it's planned, but we have some things we need to get through before we can actually do it.
Sweet. Well, Metal Guy, I want to really thank you for coming on and talking about Inkscape with us. I mean, it's an awesome application. I love it. I think it's great. We have a lot of people that are very enthusiastic about it in the IRC right now, and it's great to finally talk to somebody from the project. Two thumbs up for me, man. Great stuff.
Well, thank you very much. I'll certainly relay that to the other developers, because it's very much an effort of many people.
And I look forward to each and every release. It's just a great application.
Thank you, and I hope we can keep improving it.
I have no doubts that you will. No doubts in my mind. And we want to thank you for coming on the show and taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us.
Yeah, no problem. And,
anything else you'd like to say? Because we're just about out of time.
Don't know. I feel like I've kind of been rambling on with longer answers than I should have, but...
Our audience likes that.
Okay. Well,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. No. And there's really, as far as Inkscape goes, I kind of feel like I've exhausted the topic unless there were other questions. There's certainly a lot of other projects I'm involved with in one way or another I could talk about, but that could take a while. I've been involved with open source for... it's getting on to about at least a decade and a half, I guess. And over the years, not just Metal Guy, but I've done things under other names too. I've been involved in a lot, and it's just been kind of interesting to see the whole open source field evolve from something that was back in the days of the MIT, early Unix in the MIT world was, the way things were done, and then there's the whole rise of the proprietary software kind of thing where, they're basically subsidizing development with licensing fees at the expense of the users, usually, to kind of this gradual return to a more... open and really a more sustainable, model with open source. I think really the biggest challenge for open source right now is in terms of being able to have some sort of conventions or infrastructure or something like that in place to allow people who have resources but not programming skill to be able to fund the development of particular features that they are interested in. There's not really a lot of stuff in place with that right now. The whole thing with feature bounties is interesting, but I don't necessarily think that really works that well. So I really think we kind of need to come up with something new, and I don't know what the answer to that is going to look like yet. This is something that has really been brought to my attention in recent, maybe in the past year or so. It's sort of been a question that was always hanging around on the periphery of Inkscape again, because we always have features that people are really interested in that they would gladly pay money for, but we have no real way to actually do anything useful with their money. Actually, for a long time, Inkscape didn't even take donations. It eventually reached a point where we had people finding ways to give us money anyway, even though I didn't want to accept it, that we finally broke down and incorporated so we could do it. But it's still, there's still a problem of, it's great that you can donate to the project, but it's really much better if you could contribute capital to something specific you actually want done. And really needs to be better ways to do that, not just for Inkscape, but for open source in general.
I have three quick questions that I'm being forced to ask, of course. One is, what Linux distribution are you using? Two is VI or Emacs? And three, what's your window manager of choice or desktop?
These days I've been using Metacity with GNOME, just because that's the platform I'm developing for. I work for Canonical now.
So you use Ubuntu, I take it, yes?
Yep.
VI or Emacs?
VI,
Nano.
Pretty much.
Oh, VI?
Yeah, the reason for that is just not because, you know, VI is necessarily that great, but I'm used to it. And if you have a system that is so screwed up you can't even get into single-user mode, I wouldn't want to try to start Emacs on that. But, you know, you start VI and you can actually do something useful through system recovery. So it seems like a good skill to keep practice with.
Yeah, I know. Doesn't Ubuntu favor Nano?
I think that's what it tends to default to, just because that's Nano is, if you don't have background with either Emacs or VI and you just want to do some text editing, Nano is probably about the best you can do on the console as far as something that people won't get lost in, like, you know, either, you know, both VI and Emacs have, even just to quit the program, which most people want to do once they get lost, is a very difficult thing.
Yeah.
So Nano doesn't have that problem.
No, it doesn't. I always forget how to quit out of Emacs because I use VI all the time. So.
Yeah. I'm sure Emacs users have the same complaint. So that's an interesting thing, actually. Being able to quit a program is kind of a very essential piece of usability.
Yeah. I remember the first time I ended up in VI and didn't know how to get out of it. Good things. What about the rest of you people on this line? Nothing from any of you? Pat? Alan? Dave?
To be honest, I don't use Inkscape. It's one of those programs that, you know, I need to learn at some point.
Mm-hmm. It's fun to use, but if you don't, depending on what you do, then you may not really have much actual reason to use it. So, and that's how it goes. Everyone has a different set of things they do. I happen to do a little bit of everything, so I've used pretty much everything in the open source stack at one time or another, but most people choose to actually focus on something and be good at it rather than being a dabbler in everything.
I'm just not artistic. I would love to be able to use it, but I don't know what I'm doing. If I knew what I was doing, it wouldn't help.
I have the same problem there. I lack any artistic genes.
Yeah. Well, the main thing that you might use Inkscape for is making a diagram or something like that. Now, for some things, I think Daya might be better. But we are trying to improve the diagramming features in Inkscape as well. I think we have a way to go on that, but it is something on our radar.
Yeah, I was going to say, I like to think I can do stuff in it, but then I watch something like with HeathenX at the screencasters, screencasters.heathenx.org, what he does, and I'm like, man, I would never have thought to do that way. I must have missed something on the artistic capability bus. I was absent that day at school or something.
That's the kind of thing that... One of the things about artistic ability is that it really requires, there's some amount of native ability to it, but the other thing is it requires a lot of practice, no matter, unless you're like, you know, a Mozart of art, you basically have to practice it a lot to get to that point. And at that point, however much native talent you have, and usually the this goes with native talent, it has to be something that appeals to you to spend that much time on it. So I think people beat themselves up a little bit too much about not having artistic talent when it's basically something that no matter where you're starting out from, you have to spend a lot of time on. And if it's not something that interests you, don't beat yourself up over it. On the other hand, if the only thing that was stopping you was because you felt like you didn't have talent to start, but it interests you, then the only way to really get around that is to go ahead and start practicing and realize that it, you know, it's just going to take, you actually have to keep doing it. That's the only way that you improve. And one of the other things to realize, too, is that although Heathenex does some really amazing things in the screencasts and so forth, generally speaking, especially until you've had years and years of practice, it takes a long time. One of the things that I kind of learned painting was really getting a sense for how much time it really does take, you know, tens of hours to get close to a finished product, unless you're a really unusually good painter or you know, good at just sort of slapping something together. And really, I mean, I am not a bad painter, but I think I would be a much better painter if I had more patience, because I don't have... It took me a long time to realize, but it basically, if I really want to produce a polished piece, it's probably going to be 40 hours of work to start. If I do it enough, I can get faster at it. But it's the main thing. I think, you know, it basically comes down to, is this something that interests you enough to spend the time on it? And don't, you know, on one hand, don't feel bad if it's not really that interesting to you. And on the other hand, if it interests you, but you don't feel like you have talent, then don't worry about that either, because you basically just got to do it. And don't worry about how it looks at first. Just, you know, keep doing, keep practicing, and you can get better that way. And also look for, you know, mentorship as well. That can accelerate the process quite a bit. There's also some good books like Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain as far as representational art goes. And the one thing I hear a lot is, in the context of art, is, well, you know, but I can't draw a straight line. But I can't draw a straight line myself. It's really not so much about fine motor control as it is about sort of developing or unlearning habits of that you've developed in seeing stuff. Because a lot of times when, you know, you look at something like you see a bicycle, your brain, you know, puts all these pieces together, and by the time you're actually thinking about what you're seeing, you're thinking, I see a bicycle. And what a lot of people will do then is they try to draw the bicycle, and they sort of draw this schematic picture of a bicycle, which is, you know, it has wheels and it has, you know, handles and a seat, but it doesn't actually look much like the bicycle they're looking at. And a lot of learning to do representational art is basically training your brain to turn off all of those higher levels of interpretation, so you're not quite seeing a bicycle anymore. You're seeing, well, there's this area, there's this sort of gray area here, and there's a little bit of a highlight on there, and just to be able to look at stuff at a much lower level in terms of, you know, well, there's this sort of, you know, the roundish shape here, and there's a straightish line here that goes so far, and being able to look at things at a much lower level. That's something else that requires practice and really a specific kind of practice. That's actually the thing that art lessons help with the most, is learning how to see or how not to see, essentially. There's really a lot of things that go into art. The biggest thing, again, is spending the time with it and not worrying too much about comparing yourself versus some ideal, because it's going to take you a long, long time to get there. And the second is you know, finding a good mentorship or, you know, a good situation to learn in to help you with things like, again, you know, learning how to see as an artist, break things down into form and color and that sort of thing. Anyway.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on. Alan's yelling at me to close up shop because we're getting past time, but I really appreciate your time.
And sadly, I'm old and have to get my sleep.
Sleep? What's that?
It's something I don't get enough
of. Our senior citizen has to get.
Senior citizen gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning, that's why.
Oh, yikes. Yeah, we should definitely wrap up. I didn't realize it was 10:30. So, I've had a great time. Thank you again for having me.
Well, thank you for
anytime.
Coming on.
You're always welcome back. Maybe next time you could come back with one of the other devs.
Definitely. I at least one. It definitely could be possible to arrange. So, we'll have to talk offline about doing if we want to do it another time or whatever. But anyway, so we should kind of wrap up here.
All right. We do have a song for tonight, but before I play us out, any of you guys have anything else you want to comment on? Joel? 3:30?
No, not really.
My dryer?
Is that what
and
that
whitey.
Was?
Yeah. Well, you know how these things go. I have to make sure the wife has her laundry for tomorrow. All right. Tonight we're going to play an instrumental song off of Incompetech.com, royalty-free music.
Nice.
Released under the Creative Commons, called Malt Shop Bop. I'll post the link to where I got it. You could play this over and over again while you're working on Inkscape, your next wonderful masterpiece in Inkscape, or reading webcomics. There we go. Don't forget CosFest this week. And Southeast Linux Fest is coming up, right, Dave Yates?
Yes. June 13th.
Your wife's going to have a buffet for everybody, right?
No. She's cleaning her shotgun already.
Just waiting for you, Dan.
That's it. Movie Ding Dong. Boom! Boom! Boom!
I can smell something. It's got to be Dan.
That's not nice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
But you did like the chair, though. The fart chair. Anyways, play us out, man.
Alright, I'm going to play us out. Hold on. Make sure everything's ready to go. I feel like I'm forgetting Adoba. Don't worry, you'll get your Doba today.
Have you had your Doba today?
But, all right.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Good night. Next week, it's just us. Thank you, Metal Guy. Appreciate everything you've done. And without further ado, here it is, Malt Shop Bob.
Thank you.
Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13th, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's fact. If you don't like the gas, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are linking bad. For the streaming, go direct to DLNGS.org. And I see channels at LinuxLink.net. Bound tech show. Just in right there, goes the calendar just about to begin.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
And that's it for this week. Is everybody gone?
I'm still here.
Nah, I'm still here.
I'm still here.
Hey, there's three of us. Four.
Everybody except the old man.
You'd be able to quick.
Grandpa Metzler is gone. We gave him his prunes and he went to bed. Well, be that as it may, gentlemen, I have to get moving myself. So yeah, I have to leave you with your Doba song of the week.
Yeah, I'd better get going as well. But
yeah, you want to get going really fast before this comes on.
Yes, I do. Alright, good night, folks.
Thank you very much, little guy. Have a good one.
Yeah, you're welcome. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
99. 99, Pat. Dave.
Night and night. Bye, guys.
3:30 still
night
on?
Night and night.
Yeah.
Night and night, 3:30.
Yeah, night.
Next week, prepared to talk.
Yeah.
Sorry I was late, guys.
That's okay.
You know what? Late or not at all or whenever, you're welcome to come on. You don't have to. It's not a requirement. Thank you, though. Have a happy.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
See you on Saturday. Night, night and night. And here it is. In celebration of Inkscape, we have a Doba song called Scan Vector Alignment. I don't know what it means. Neither do they, probably, but here it is. Alright, that's enough of that. As much as I want to play a year in Nova, I don't have time to finish out the other 9 minutes of this song. That's too much. Maybe I'll play the second half next week. Yeah, come back for that next week. Oof, this is way too much. Way too much. Sorry, folks. I apologize for that. I apologize. Claudio, you have to come back next week. Next week for the rest of it. Way too long. Way too long. Have a happy. Bye.
Oh, I never really ever watched that show.
And that show, St. Elsewhere, the whole show was basically imagined by some, like, autistic kid or something.
I kind of remember that one.
But was it Dynasty or Dallas that...
Dallas had the one where Bobby was killed. And then it wound up, it was just a dream or something.
Yeah, okay, it was Dallas then.
It's basically the reset button.
The jumping of the shark, so to speak.
That's like the cop-out of like, TV show writers. They can't think of, you know, a clever way of getting out of something, so they hit the reset button.
They hit it with a tachyon pulse.
Yeah, I think the last three Star Trek series were basically that.
You reconfigure the main main deflector array to emit a tachyon pulse, and everything will be saved. Can you tell I watch too much Star Trek?
I don't know. One of my kids' toys was just talking.
Did it tell you not to go into the light?
Don't go into the light. There's the light.
Carol Ann.
Whoa, somebody went into the statue. Whoa. Whoa,
somebody went into that's really loud.
Is that me?
Bring it down.
Oh, I can fix it. Bring it down. Hello?
Yeah, it's a lot better.
A little bit loud.
Hello?
Still loud.
How's that?
Do you have your mic boost on?
It shut down some. Did it need to shut all the way out?
I think your mic boost is on.
Better.
That's better. Did you turn your mic boost off?
That's better.
Yep. Hey, who am I talking to?
This is David.
David, you should know better by now.
No, I was messing with Scott last night.
You're fired.
I think that messed it up.
It's funny you say that. My five-year-old is saying that.
That David's fired?
No, he goes around telling everybody that they're fired.
How was your vacation, Dave?
He goes, Daddy, you're fired.
Hey. It was all right.
Kids, the weather hold up
breaks.
For you?
It was just... We were gone on the sunny days, and we were here for the rainy days. So it worked out okay. It didn't rain while we were camping. So.
Well, that's definitely a plus. Getting soaking wet during camping is not fun.
Oh, yeah. That's always fun. But how you feeling, Dan?
Like crap. Not
did
good.
You have to hear?
What's that?
I was trying to find the mute button on Akiga, and it didn't seem to mute anything.
We used to go camping down at the Indian River Inlet, which is the shore in Delaware, right outside of Rehoboth Beach, and we had a camper, but my parents made us stay in a tent. And we had to dig a trench around the tent about 6 inches to a foot deep because when it rained there, it turned into a huge mud puddle, and it would just be horrendous. So the one year I went down with my then-girlfriend in college at the time, and it just so happened my parents decided to come down at the same time, and they had stayed in a hotel, and we were in a tent that I had. And they stopped by the one night, and man, it was blowing so hard. A storm was coming in that the tent was practically laid flat by the wind while we were in it.
Hello.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. I was listening to a fascinating story.
Oh. We were talking about camping trips.
I always hated going camping. My parents dragged me when I was younger, and then thank God I got a job and couldn't go anymore.
Do that mental guy?
Yes.
Do you want to call you mental guy? Or mental?
Just mental.
Okay.
What most people call me conversationally.
Okay. Why is the mental guy can come in sounding perfect, and Dave Yates, who's done this for like 2 years, sounds like he was coming in from Australia?
How many of you are using Akiga, and how many of you are calling in?
I've got Akiga on.
I'm on SJ phone.
And I'm connected via a hard SIP phone.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I just pulled in with my cell phone, so,
What time is it? 8:25. Oh, we have 5 minutes.
So what other good stories do you have to interview camping trips? Any toilets backing up or what?
No. Actually, oh, man. When we'd go camping, when we were finished, like, we were never allowed to use the bathroom in the camper because it was a small tank, so we had to use the public bathroom. But the first time we had, you know, we had the
new Dan.
First time we took the camper on a camping trip, at the end of the trip, you'd always go up to the sanitation area and empty out your bathroom trap and everything, your tank, because you don't want to be driving down the highway with a full tank. And you have no place to empty it at your house, but they had facilities there. And, man, my dad was cursing up a storm because whoever had the camper before has never emptied it out. And I swear to God, it looked like a whole loaf of burnt toasted bread came out of there. But right next to the sanitation area was what I used to call the swamp. And I used to go in there and catch minnows and stuff for fishing. And I loved that place, man. Every summer I'd go in there and I'd spend just all day chomping through the mud and catching bait fish and crabs and all sorts of stuff. So I went there with Aaron. We went down there and stayed in a tent. And I was like, you know, you got to come to the swamp with me. And I went into the swamp, and she didn't appreciate it as much as I did because the mud in there was like a foot deep. So she was tromping around the swamp, and she got out, you know, a couple of feet, and she was having a hard time, and she fell over into the mud and just went pow right down into it, and that was the end of her in the mud. She was pissed off about that. So then we took her and hosed her down in the sanitation area, and she never went back.
And you realized the mud was because it was from the sanitation area?
No, it wasn't because of that. But she never went back to the swamp again. There are rats as big as dogs running around over there. Like, they were bigger than cats.
You can see that in New York City, Dan. Just go down into the subway and look down the train tracks. You'll see them.
Yeah, what I don't get is they had a Monster Quest about giant rats.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And I'm like, they're like trying to prove whether they exist or not. I mean, I've seen them. Like, the rats down at the shore were huge. One year I was sleeping outside under the awning, the camper, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and there was a rat in my hand.
Oh, nasty. Was he, like, gnawing on your nose or something?
No, they just, you know, he ran across my chest and took off. They weren't gnawing on you, but you're, like, right there against the water's edge, and it's, you know, you're right out there in nature, man. There's rats all over the rocks and everything. They come out at night, mostly.
I was doing wiring once in a crawl space in a basement, and you shimmied in on my back to get where I had to go. It took me, 10 minutes to get where I had to go. on it, and suddenly I felt like there's something run across the bottom of my, you know, bottom of my legs on it. Man, I tell you, I was out of that place in like 2 minutes flat. Like, I ain't going back up there. It's one thing when it's a spider, but man, when there's weight to it, it's time to get the hell out of there.
Rodents don't bother me. Actually, most creatures, animals don't bother me. My uncle wanted to have me help him with his carpenter bee problem. And we went upstairs with a can of Raid in his rafters at his barn. And there was this big tile there. And you could hear buzzing from under it. And he's like, lift it up and I'll spray it. So I walked over and lifted it up, and the whole thing was just covered with carpenter bees. And he's like sitting there shooting at them, and I'm like, this isn't a good idea. Because if these things decide to go, we're in trouble.
Nothing like fire ants, right?
Yeah, they're not too nice. My mother-in-law has a problem with fire ants. I'm surprised Dave Yates doesn't have a problem with fire ants.
Oh, we got them.
Well, I hope you have your backyard cleaned up in time for...
I had to replace a couple of pool pumps.
Yeah. You hope you have your backyard cleaned up by self. Because I don't want to be camping in a fire ant pile.
The hell with camping? Where's the hotels down there?
All right.
You need to get a list of hotels so when we're down there... Dan can go camping. I need porcelain. I want porcelain facilities.
I just plan on using a bucket on Dave Yates' porch.
Oh, that's just bad.
We got a list of hotels now, Alan, on the page, and I'm getting ready to add the official hotel of self this evening. Probably.
Okay, cool.
And we got a place to give us a discount, so.
Excellent.
Oh, we still have one more week of CosFest. What part of the world are you from, mental guy? Mental.
Oh, so I'm originally from the east coast of the U.S.
Where about on the east coast? Because
we're
all from the east
Baltimore.
Coast. Oh.
Baltimore.
Are you on the west coast
Baltimore.
Now?
Baltimore.
Are you on the west coast now?
No, not right now.
You're on the East Coast now?
Yep.
Okay. In Baltimore?
Yep.
You hang out there at
Dan,
the aquarium?
It's very eerily quiet on your end now.
That's because there's no more jet engine going. It's just one server.
And the dryer.
And the dryer. Can you hear the dryer?
Yeah.
We can hear the dryer in the background.
Well, as soon as I start the show, I'll leave this room.
Actually, I've not been to the Baltimore Aquarium for, well, really into Baltimore for a while. Just trying to think of the last time. I think the last time I was down in Baltimore was when a friend of mine was in town and met up there. Down in Harbor Place.
Ah, I like
Dan.
I
that,
like
was, that was eerie when you turned your mic off. It was like so quiet.
Yeah. Last time I was down at the Inner Harbor, I bought some porn, a loaf of bread, and peanut butter.
Not necessarily in that order.
There was any connection.
No, not at all.
Good.
Actually, they were on separate days. And it was back in high school, so that was a long time ago. Haven't been back since.
The porn lasted you that long, huh?
I don't even know whatever happened to that. I lent it to somebody and I never got it back. All right, are we ready to go, gentlemen?
To do it.
Yeah, I think let's start the recording and let's do this thing.
Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you we did start the recording. All right,
okay.
So we're going to play the intro. Have you ever listened to our show before?
Not much, no. I listened a little bit earlier this week, but I really haven't missed a chance.
All right, no problem. I just wanted to let you know that we're going to start the show. You'll hear our audio intro. We're doing a couple of promos for some Linux Fests, and then we'll get right into talking to you. It's
cool.
Really off the cuff, so